Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning back in to the Why You Know Doctor podcast. Today, I have Vanessa Pham on the show. She's the co-founder of Omsom and started it with her sister with the mission of reclaiming Asian flavors through her sauces, seasonings, and aromatics. In America, so much of the Asian sauces, seasonings, and more found in the ethnic or Asian grocery store aisles don't do a good job representing everything that Asian cuisines have to offer. Omsom brings cultural integrity to their products through partnerships with iconic Asian chefs, and they source 90% of their ingredients from Asia. I love what Vanessa and her sister are doing with Omsom, and when it comes to their products, their mission, and also their story as the kids of Vietnamese refugees. We talk about Vanessa's story, the process to start the business, her experience with investors, and many other Asian American identity topics I'm sure many of you can relate to. Without further ado, here is Vanessa. Vanessa, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Really appreciate it. I'm happy that we found you.
Yeah, I'm super excited to chat. When I read the concept of the podcast, I was like, yes, we need this. I'm super excited to tell my story and kind of meet you, Dominic.
Yeah. Do you want to just start off by sharing a little bit more about kind of like Omsom and your company? I know like recently you guys have been really blowing up, like getting really popular, and that's really exciting to see.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. So Omsom is actually, we're a new company. We're only 10 months old, but basically Omsom is a new pantry staple brand, specifically focused on Asian food. And we exist to reclaim Asian flavors and create products that honor and celebrate the communities that we represent. Basically, we work with iconic chefs to craft starters with cultural integrity. And all these chefs are like of these backgrounds, either, you know, their parents or themselves are literally from these countries. And that's really important to us. So our product allows you to make your favorite Asian dishes at your house in less than 20-30 minutes.
Got it. And when you say, I forgot exactly how you phrased it, but you said like reclaim, was it like the how did you phrase it?
Yeah, reclaiming Asian flavors, creating products with cultural integrity.
So today, like, would you say before Omsom or before other companies, maybe like you guys, like what would be, or like, what does that mean specifically? Is there,
Yeah. Well, you know, I can tell you it kind of like leads right into the origin, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, what we, much like many other Asians in America, we had this experience of, you know, when we were kids going to the grocery store, looking at like Asian products, like mainstream grocery store, right? Going to your Whole Foods or your Kroger or your Wegmans and being like, what is this? This is weird. This doesn't look like anything my mom uses or my dad uses, yeah. Right? It's like very stereotypical branding with like dragons and pandas and bamboo, and the flavors are super diluted and whitewashed. And we're like, back when, even when we were kids, we knew that stuff was whack, right? And then here I am as a 26-year-old going to the grocery store and seeing the same exact shit. And you're just like, how is this still the current state of Asian flavors in the mainstream grocery store? And it was actually that experience that we were like, you know, it is time for a brand to exist in this environment that actually does right by these communities. And that's what we kind of set out to build. So that's really what we mean by reclaiming, is like the brands that have represented Asian American flavors in the grocery store for so long have not been run by Asian folks, have not been doing their diligence on what a real deal Asian flavors are. And so that's really kind of what we mean.
That makes sense. Yeah. Cause I never actually thought too much about it until I started to kind of learn more about what you guys are doing. And then it clicked for me. Like, I was like, oh, that really makes sense. Cause like as a kid, you know, like we would just go shopping at like the Asian grocery store. So then we would actually find, like, you could tell it was just like imported. And it was like, you know, that's what my parents used to cook. But like, you normally couldn't find a lot of that stuff in like the mainstream grocery, like Asian ethnic food aisles or something.
Right. And, right. Which is like a whole other thing we could talk about, how the ethnic aisle just like shouldn't exist altogether. But you know, I think for sure, I think that's exactly right. Like if you wanted to get the legit stuff, you'd have to go find an Asian market.
Yeah. So why did that come to be in the first place? Was it just like companies saw that opportunity to like mass manufacture stuff that like kind of tasted maybe similar, or maybe it didn't even taste similar at all? Just, you know, obviously, trying to like reproduce something?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's basically a couple of things. So it's like massive CPG conglomerates have that have these like, you know, deeply ingrained relationships with all the grocery stores across the nation, saw this opportunity, you know, however many years ago, mm-hmm. and were like, oh, we need to create like Asian like products. So they like spun off and like created little brands within these like massive CPGs, and they created products that were not intended to basically be for an Asian audience at all, mm-hmm. nor were they intended to be really respectful for an Asian audience. I don't think that was on the radar of these CPG companies. And even today, if they wanted to create a brand that was respectful and delicious and actually like, you know, representative of how these flavors might taste to yeah. an Asian audience or in an Asian home, like, I don't think they could do it. Like, they don't know how to do the R&D in that way. So I think like, from my perspective, it's been a product of these massive CPG conglomerates trying to represent Asian flavors.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so the thing that you guys do differently is you mentioned that you partner with specific, is it like chefs or is it like people who like create these recipes or how what's like that process look like?
Yeah. So, you know, from day one, my sister and I were very, very clear that like, you know, while we're Asian, you know, we're yeah. Vietnamese American, yeah. we're not experts on Thai food, Japanese yeah, food, Korean sure. food, like that they're all so different. And to try to like, you know, make this Pan-Asian thing, we're like, that doesn't make sense to us. And so from day one, we decided like part of the business model is to work with who we call tastemakers, who are these like iconic chef partners. And our tastemakers, they own like awesome restaurants around the country. They have James Beard nominated cookbooks. They have award-winning restaurants. And not only are they like integral to the product development process and the marketing process, like making sure we're talking about these dishes in the right way and making sure that we're educated on the history of the dish, and making sure the flavors are super tight, and sourcing all the ingredients. The other thing that we make sure is that they're equitably compensated. So that's a really important part of this. So like part of this is representation, but I think there's so much more to it than that. And for us, equitable compensation is giving them a cut of sales on their product that they work with us on, like into the future, versus other brands do like project fees, like one-off things, but like we really want to think about how many flows and we want to make sure that they're compensated into the future.
That's really cool. So how did you initially get that idea? It's because it kind of reminds me of maybe like if you're like an artist and you like create something, like if there's a lot of recurring usage of it, like you kind of get, well, a lot of times people don't do that, but it is how it should be done, you know?
right.
But what influenced you guys to think like that?
You know, I think it was really just coming from a place of our mission, which is to like at our core, like our mission is to amplify the Asian American community, Asian stories and Asian flavors. And if we are going to do that the way that like we like really set out to do from day one, I think equitable compensation is just like a core part of that. And for like, basically for these chefs, they've built their names and their careers in these respective cuisines, like that flavor in that product, like we can't undervalue how important that is. And they played such an important role in driving that. So we thought that like the most equitable way would be to do basically kind of this like cut of sales into the future.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. And I assume that probably is pretty incentivizing for like a lot of the creators or like maybe the original people that create those things. Like, cause I assume you guys will continue to come out with like new, I don't know what you call it, just like new products.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is, I mean, when we first approached the chefs, we were nobody. I mean, we hadn't launched yet. Right. So, cause we needed them to launch. And so like, they didn't actually think it sounded that enticing cause they thought we were going to like, you know, sell like very little. So they were like, okay, sure. Like I'll do it. But like, I don't even know if I'm going to like make much from this type thing. And we're really excited. The last payment that we paid out to our chefs was like upwards of $16,000 across our chefs. Yeah. And like, we were so happy to be able to do that, especially during this time that's been so difficult for hospitality. And we even posted about it on our Instagram for like complete transparency, for like accountability. And yeah, it means a lot to us. They're like amazing people, and it's been a really hard time for them.
Yeah, you guys grew really fast. Because did you, so 10 months ago, were you, was this like, when did the idea originate and when did you guys start to? Because I feel like 10 months is like super fast.
Yeah, no, my sister and I have been working on the idea for more than 2 years.
Okay.
But you like launched. Like, we launched in May of 2020.
Got it. Was there any like, do you have any like advice on like, obviously you guys probably did all the foundational work and the planning ahead of time, but when it comes to even launching it, like, is there like a good method for, cause you guys just got, I just feel like you got, I mean, I don't know that much about this industry, but it's just like 10 months. I feel like with the traction that you guys have gotten, it's pretty like, you know, it's really good, I think, right?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, it's like beyond anything we could have expected. We sold out in the first 72 hours because that was like the level of our ambition or expectation, at least. Let's say our ambition is very high, but like yeah. Our expectation, like we like did not expect the response that we've gotten this quickly. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about with launching. I think like, you know, the biggest piece of advice I can offer at like a high level is to be extremely focused with your efforts and what you expect that to create for you. So I think a lot of brands, when they're launching, they try to do a little bit of everything and like, okay, we need to be on that platform, this platform, this community. And they end up just diluting everything. So they do everything like kind of like so-so. But instead, what we did was we were super clear about what platforms, what audience, who we were speaking to, I think is like probably the most important question. That way you can actually make a meaningful dent in one specific community versus like a very like kind of light, I guess like you just never get momentum if you're not focused. And I think early on with fewer resources, with less brand equity, less brand awareness, knowing exactly who you're speaking to and like tailoring for impact is very, very important.
Got it. And did you already, did you come into this already with like a lot of experience? I believe you mentioned that you were a consultant already at, I think it was like Bain or like some big company, right? Yeah. And then your sister, I think you mentioned to me like another time that she was at like Blue Apron or something. So is that,
you guys came with some experience? Yeah, we definitely had some relevant experience. I would say, okay. I mean, both of us are first-time founders and both of us didn't have like direct, I would say like, CPG experience, like food CPG experience. But yeah, in my
sorry, what is CPG? What is CPG?
Consumer packaged goods.
Oh, consumer packaged goods.
So okay. Consumer packaged goods is like, yeah, stuff in the grocery store, you know? And you know, so definitely like I would say we had helpful experience. So my background, yes, I was a management consultant at Bain, and there I did try to like basically advise more like as many clients as I could that were in the CPG space. So I had a chance to advise like some Fortune 500 CPGs and some retailers as well. And that was really, really helpful experience. And then actually before that, I ran a $3 million e-commerce business while I was a student at Harvard. And that was a ton of fun, grew the e-commerce website like 40% in a year. And I was like, oh, maybe this is like something I can actually consider doing down the road. And then my sister, her whole background has always been in startups and VC. Yeah. As I mentioned that she worked at Blue Apron, like really early days when they were like one warehouse in Bushwick.
Got it. Okay, cool. Yeah, it makes sense. And I think one reason is like, you know, obviously I think I want people to appreciate that you probably had like a lot of, you know, you've already worked really hard and like gathered or gained a lot of experience. It's not like you just like had this idea and you're like, you know, it's like, it's not that easy to grow like an e-commerce store and like to grow the revenues. Like you learn a lot during that process, I'm sure.
Definitely not easy. And I mean, so much of this is like luck. Like I really believe that. And yeah, and obviously like there's so much that I could say as far as like the challenges we've had and like, you know, unfair things we've faced maybe in fundraising, but I also feel like extremely privileged in many other ways too. So,
cool. Let's dive back a little bit in time. And I'm curious to learn a little bit more about kind of your childhood, your upbringing, family, and like kind of like the path that ultimately got you to where you are now. So where did you grow up? Like,
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town 30 minutes south of Boston. It was 98.5% white, Irish, Italian, Catholic town. So it was a pretty hard place to grow up in as a Asian American child of Vietnamese refugees. But I wouldn't change things about my upbringing. It just was like it was definitely a hard place to grow up. My parents came to the US from Vietnam in like 1981. They're a huge part of who I am, my identity, and my journey. They're like huge supporters of AungSam. I have learned so much from them and I love them dearly. They're a huge part of who I am. And yeah, so I basically grew up in this hometown, struggled with my identity for a long time. By the time I left, I was like, or at least probably by the time I was in high school, I felt like I kind of like hit a groove and became proud of my identity and still a journey. I went to school in Cambridge at Harvard.
Can I ask actually real quick, just
Yeah.
regarding the like your identity and like growing up, like what was difficult about it, and like what were some of the things that kind of maybe you struggled with or you were conflicted about or that you thought about a lot?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, I feel like a lot of it was like how, my relationship to being a Vietnamese American. Like as a kid, like you don't even really understand it. The first time I think I came to understand it, like that I was Vietnamese American and that I was like different than the rest, was because kids were pointing it out to me and like making fun of me or like saying things about, whatever. Like playing with their eyes or the classic stuff, right? That's how you confront it is like from a place of shame, right? You're like, oh, I'm just a person. And then you realize, oh, wait, you're not in the eyes of these people, you're not just a person, you're specific something and it's lesser than. So grappling with that as a young kid was just I honestly I don't have like clear, I don't even know what my thought process was. I probably just internalized it as like this deep shame. And like even to this day, I'm an extremely social person and I can get along with most people and I love conversation, but I do find myself in situations like if I feel othered or if I don't feel welcome, I sometimes revert to being that little girl like on the playground that was made fun of. Like I can get really upset and scared like out of the blue, like it just hits me like that. And like that's trauma. That's what that is, So, I'm starting to like grapple with it now. I think I forgot about it, honestly, because once I got to college and my adult life, I just like I and then now I'm like so proud, right? But it's been a freaking journey. And I think being in that hometown, like, yeah, I think it affected me in ways that I'm just starting to understand now.
What are some of those ways that you're starting to understand now that you're willing to share? Because I'm asking also because I think that I really understand actually a lot of what you're saying because I've probably faced a lot of it myself. I grew up in Wisconsin,
Oh dang, yeah. I
so
believe
probably
that.
in some ways a similar experience. But
Yeah, I mean, so now like my whole company and what I talk about, what I try to use my platform for is really about being super proud and unapologetic about all the incredible things of being Asian American, of Asian American culture, Asian American food. Like that's what we preach, and that's what I want people to feel. And like, so that for me has been a journey. But the weird ways in which it comes up now, it's not weird. I'm sure you actually might identify with some of it, but like things that I've noticed, like I said, like as an adult, super social, but like if somebody makes me feel unwelcome, instead of being like, oh, like I imagine if you didn't have any of this like emotional or like, this trauma, you might just be like, oh, that person doesn't get me, like whatever. Like you'd just be okay with it. But I think like the little girl in me that felt rejected and felt lesser than like sometimes comes out and instead of just being like yeah that person just doesn't get me, it's like this like much more like active rejection of that person. It's like this more defensive place that I can come from because it's like it's traumatic for me to feel that way. So it's like it ends up being maybe a more aggressive like rejection of that person of like no that person like doesn't that person's racist or which maybe they might be, but like it's definitely more of like an outsized aggressive response. And in many ways it's trying to come from a place of strength because I'm trying to like reclaim a feeling of security, I would say. So yeah, I mean, this is like literally like therapist shit that we're going through right now, but it's like stuff that I'm like And I think a lot of people might experience stuff like this, but they might not be able, like, they might not have identified it yet or understand why they respond in the ways that they do. But for me, like, at least I've been starting to try to unpack that. And yeah, no, it's hard. Like, I wish I could just be super chill, like, in situations like that. Like, I wish I could just, like, walk away and be like, oh yeah, whatever. But, like, for me, it's triggering.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. It's triggering. And I'm wondering, like, I'm trying to think, like, definitely I got triggered, I think, more when I was, like, in the last few years. I started, like, kind of go away a bit more, but, like, I remember, like, in college, like, it bothered me so much, because I also went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is, like, even more, like, I mean, there's, like, not many, I mean, there's some international students and stuff like that, but not that many Asian people. They, like, there was like a huge scandal where they, like, photoshopped you know, like, the welcome brochure, they photoshopped, like, someone that was Black into, like, the audience. No. Like, multiple times. It's the same person. Yeah, because they were trying to, like, make it more diverse. But, you know, it's like,
that's tough.
Yeah, it's really,
that's, it's so wild. That's wild.
It's really sad and funny at the same time.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, I've had, oh yeah, that's crazy. I'm sure you had some interesting, like, experiences and stories you could share there. But I've also had some, like, experiences actually in Chicago, which honestly I would say Chicago is, like, similar to Boston. But yeah, I mean, in Chicago,
yeah, it was Midwest still, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I went to, like, a bar with a group, like, friends, yeah, and, like, friends of friends, and this one guy had, like, just moved to Chicago from San Francisco, and he was really high, so he was, like, kind of acting antisocial, and I kind of felt bad, so I was like, well, like, hey, like, how's it going, you know, like, you know, how are you, like, just trying to start conversation. I noticed he was just sitting there, so he was like, oh, actually, like, it's so amazing. Like, I love it here. This place is amazing. And I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Like, what have you loved? And he was like, well, like, first night I got here last weekend, I went out with my buddy, blah, blah, blah. And we went out and I looked around, and the first thing I said to him was just, cheers to white women. And he said this to me in a one-on-one conversation. He's like, cheers to white women. And I was like, I was just so shocked. Like, I didn't even know, like, I couldn't process, right?
Yeah.
I was just quiet. And he goes, oh, well, I realize you're not white, but, like, look, like, I'm not, last three girls I slept with were Chinese, Iranian, and Black. So, like, don't worry. And I was just like,
he's just, like, digging himself a hole. That's, like, even worse.
It literally couldn't. I was so crazy. And I just, like, stood there, and I honestly felt threatened, right? Like, I didn't feel safe. Like, because he was just talking, he was just like, white supremacy, throwing white supremacy at me, and I just, like, didn't feel safe. I was just, like, confused, and I just, like, stood there, and I was like, no, like, it's fine. Like, I didn't know what to say. And then I, like, went to the bathroom, and I, like, took a second to process, and then I just started crying, and I had to go home, because it was like, it was fucking crazy. I got so angry. It was wild.
Of that stuff really, like, some of that stuff is really triggering. Like, I've just heard so many comments and stuff like that where it's like, I mean, at this point, it's just like, I mean, just to give specific examples, it's like, when I was in school, at least in college, like, people would always be like, oh, like, that's so Asian of you. And, like, I was just like, kept on being like, it's because, you know, you're not really reminded, because I would be, like, the only Asian person at every bar, at every party.
Yeah.
I'd literally be the only Asian person, unless, like, I happened to, like, I knew, like, some of the other Asian Americans on campus, because there's so few of us, you know, you naturally oh, you look like me, like, I have a similar, you know, so it's like, maybe let's be friends. But my close friends are not really mostly Asian American.
Yeah.
But, like, all the time, every party, it's like constantly, I'm just reminded, they're like, oh, it's so Asian. I'm like, yeah, like, dude, I am Asian. Like, of course it's Asian of me. It's like, it's literally who I am. Like, why do you keep saying that? You know, I just got so annoyed.
I had actually a crazy experience my freshman year. All my roommates were also not Asian. And I feel as though, like, Harvard was maybe more diverse, but at the end of the day, like still not that diverse. And I came, because I grew up in a, like, completely white town, like, when I came to college, I hung out with people that were kind of like the people from my hometown. And, like, one of my roommates was from Tennessee, And she came back from seeing her grandma. It was like after Christmas break or whatever. And she was like, oh my gosh, yeah, I showed my grandma pictures of all of us. And I was like, oh, that's so cute. And then she was like, yeah, my grandma was like, oh, like, I thought you didn't like Asian people. And I told her, oh, Vanessa's not like Asian. And I was like,
yeah,
like, that's, well, first, there's so many things that are wrong with that. So yeah, I feel you. There's these like experiences that we've had that like just stick with us, you know, that just remind us that for some people we are other or we are less than. And like, I mean, that's just what white supremacy is. But yeah, it's crazy. Like, yeah, I'll never forget those experiences.
Yeah, a lot of times like that, I feel uncomfortable, just like small things like that. And I definitely can relate. But I was thinking, yeah, another thing, it was like, also got to the point where it's like, I started just to think about, like, I didn't want it. I'm curious what you think about this too, but it's like, you know, a lot of times we spend a lot of time, like just as a community, like of Asian Americans, you know, I had Benny who he runs, he's the founder of Next Shark. And I know like his whole thing, he shows all these things that are happening and calls out like, you know, any violence or, you know, injustices and stuff like that in media towards like Asian Americans. But also like, I used to spend more time arguing with people about it, or like energy, or like trying to like educate people. And I'm just like gotten to the point where it's like, I'm like, it's such a waste of time, because it's like, I don't want to be ruining my day or like wasting my time to explain to someone, whether it's on the internet or someone else, like arguing with them. Cause I'm just like, dude, like, cause you end up just wasting your own time. That's the thing. You could be using that time to actually do a lot of cool things.
Right. And it is like, and it's also like a burden that like we shouldn't necessarily have to carry, right? Like, it's so much emotional energy to be doing that work of educating people. Like, I would say like, yeah, I really applaud people that use their platform for that. Like, I think we definitely do that at Omsong. But like, yeah, there are times where personally I'm just like, look, it's not my day. Like, I don't have to do this today. And I totally feel you on that.
Well, I think the platform is really nice, because at least it's a more scalable way where like, you're not just, cause I think a lot of people, I mean, people might disagree with me, but I think a lot of people like spend a lot of time like complaining about stuff. But if you've spent that time building something that's more of a platform or something that's more scalable, you can address those problems and you can, you know, achieve, I think, more with your time, you know, because it's like, there's just so much time that goes into like,
totally, like an intellectual and emotional energy.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very valuable.
Yeah, so valuable.
I mean, my other thing is that like, I really like, I think we should like really be amplifying Asian perspectives and like educating people on anti-Asian racism. Like, that's obviously core to what we do at Omsong, but one of the things I think is really important is that we don't like talk about that in a vacuum. And we also like talk about it contextualized within the systems of white supremacy, because I think sometimes that can like pit like BIPOC communities against each other. And I think if we just like step back, we can understand that like, this is like, we're all victims within this system, or we're all being like, you know, marginalized within the system. And it's easy to just like, you know, to just think like, you know, it's one group versus the other, but it's, I studied sociology at Harvard. And for me, that was like a huge awakening for me, because growing up as a child of refugees, like as an Asian American, we're taught this American dream, like from day one, like is part of our identity as Asian Americans. And not only is that super flattening for Asian Americans, because a lot of Asian Americans don't necessarily live that American dream. It's also just, it is a reflection of some of the privileges that Asian Americans have that Black and Brown people in America don't have, right? Like growing up, my parents were like, if you work hard enough in this country, like you can achieve anything. Like this idea of this like meritocracy in America, but for so many communities that doesn't exist. And I think talking about like, or just like my evolution, like when I left high school, like I just fully believed in this. And then, after I studied sociology and learned about like the systems of oppression against Black and Brown folks, it like totally just shattered my understanding, or like kind of changed the way I thought about the American dream.
So what made you initially go into studying sociology?
You know, I have always been just so fascinated by culture and by institutions and by organizations and their ability to affect people's behavior. So like, I love psychology, like I love understanding like the individual, but I think to me it gets much more interesting when you put that in conversation with other forces. Like, you know, obviously like physical forces are interesting, but much more interesting to me is like cultural forces.
What would be like a physical force versus like a cultural, like just an example of one?
I mean, I guess like a physical force might be more of like, or closer to physical might be like maybe the way a building is built, or like the way communities are physically organized. And which is maybe also somewhat related to sociology, because at the end of the day, probably a government organization made that decision. But I think like, So that it started with just like a more personal interest in that. And then when I was thinking about like a career in business, I was like, I thought that like the combination of like sociology and economics would be like a really interesting combination to like go into business with, because economics is like ultimately like how do people make decisions, and then sociology is kind of bringing on that like organizational element to it and like layering that on. I thought would be really interesting, and I absolutely loved it. I mean, economics was it was fine, but sociology was like truly like became more of like a just personal passion of mine.
Got it. So at that point, did you already know that you wanted to go into business or do any of that type of stuff? Or
one of my like funny I guess like things about me, dorky high school things, is that I was like an international champion in accounting applications. So that's my fun fact. And basically,
I don't even know what that means. Like, so competition of
accounting application. So basically I would like do these competitions where like there, part of it was just these like 200 multiple choice tests in like business judgment and like accounting. But the really fun part was the business role plays, where I had to like go to the judges and pretend I was like an accountant or a financial analyst. And like, they would give me like financial statements, and I would like number crunch and like assess them, and then I would like give them recommendations and stuff based on financial ratios and like looking at their financials, and I had to like pretend I was
and like, how did you get good at that? Like, did you like study that when you were a kid or something?
I took accounting in high school. We had an accounting course. And then like when I got to the I won states and I was going to internationals. Mm-hmm. I actually went to the local community college and I asked the professors to like spend an hour with me a week, and they were willing to do it. So that also helped. Yeah.
Were your parents pretty, were they kind of like tiger parents, like stereotypical Asian parents, or like they're more chill?
My parents were like the opposite of that. Since day one, they were adamant about making us extremely independent. They didn't look at our report cards. They like, it was a very intentional effort from mostly my dad doing a lot of the thought leadership, like thinking about like, what is the type of parent he wanted to be? How did he, like, if he wanted us to be fiercely independent, like how could he set us up for that? So I'm really grateful for my parents. I mean, our relationship is not like without challenges, and like, you know, a lot of the challenges that I think immigrant children face, we definitely have with them. But like, when it comes to the way that they raise us in terms of like our relationship to like school and work, I think they really tried to set us up to be independent and have a healthy relationship. Like, I have my own, like, I guess I kind of took it and run with it anyways. Like, most people who meet me might be like, oh, you probably have a tiger mom, like, because I'm so hard on myself and I have such a high bar. But that just came from like me hearing their stories of being Vietnamese refugees and me taking those to heart and like making it my life's mission to do right by them. But that was like in my own doing, like their stories just really inspired me. But they were not tiger parents. So pretty lucky in that regard.
Yeah, that's cool. I mean, it's funny because it's like so many of the guests, sometimes I'm just a little curious about kind of like the parents and the how they raised, like, you know, some of my guests. And like, way more often than not, like, people are like, yeah, like, I wasn't even a good student, like my parents never cared about it. And it's funny because it's like, I don't know if it's maybe just the sample size, I probably had 50 guests on here, but like so many of them, like, they're now like doing a lot of really cool things. It's not like they were like raised traditionally by like a tiger tiger parents, you know? So I find that kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, if you think about what tiger parenting is, at the end of the day, it's trying to make sure your kid does the thing that feels like most likely to set them up for a position of not necessarily reaching their full potential, but just like safety, like status in society and like financial safety. It's not necessarily like, you know, taking risk and doing things that are going to like, you know, shape culture and stuff. So that could be related to it. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm sure there's so many kids that were raised by tiger parents that break out of that. But like, I imagine if my parents were telling me like to make the safe decision, I don't think I would have ever started on some.
Yeah. Okay. So you kind of had a little bit of a background in business already. You like won these competitions, I guess, or like at least you're really good at maybe accounting or some other things. I don't know. But so did you know that you're gonna like do your own, like found your own company at some point, or were you, or you're just like, I want to work.
God, no. Yeah. I was very risk averse myself. Okay. So like, yeah, that's why I was like, when I graduated from Harvard, or even like me wanting to get into Harvard was, or like, I didn't want to go to Harvard. Actually, I was just like, I wanted to go to a good school. And like, even that desire came from a place of like risk averseness of like, I want to maximize my chances of like, you know, social mobility, whatever. I didn't think I knew that term back then, but same thing with working at Bain, right? Like I was just like, what's a brand name I can slap on my resume and de-risk my life. And it wasn't until like 2 years into Bain that I was like, or like a year into Bain, I would say, that I was like, oh, this is not what I want. Like I realized like I have this safety net. It's not satisfying or fulfilling to me. And that was like a really big realization for me. And that's ultimately what kind of gave me the courage to take a leap like this. And also just witnessing my sister. My sister's been, she's very different than me. She's like down with risk. She's always tried to be like really different and try different things. She often rejected a lot of like the traditional markers of success in a way that I was, versus I like flocked to them. And watching her journey, like she graduated from NYU Stern, and like, I think she got 430 under 30 in Europe at age 24. And like, she was like speaking at conferences around the world at age 24 because she was taking risk. And I was watching her journey being like, dang, I was like, oh wow. Like that's how you do it. Like, that's how you drive cultural change. That's how you make a platform for yourself, is like, you take risks, you put yourself out there, you speak about the things you care about. And eventually people will listen if you can do so in a way that resonates with them. And I felt pretty stifled at Bain for that. I was like, nobody cares about what I have to say. Like, hopefully my manager takes my input at the meeting of a team of five. I was like, I'd be lucky if that happened. And that wasn't enough for me at that point. I was like,
what made you kind of be okay and have that change of heart? I mean, obviously, like, I think what I'm hearing is that you kind of like reached a breaking point where like you spent 2 years at Bain and, you know, you just realized that you weren't able to make like the impact that you wanted to. But I feel like that's still kind of like, if you have that risk aversion mentality, it's still probably like not that easy unless you're kind of, I mean, cause like, I feel like those companies do a lot to try to keep you there. Right.
Oh yeah. They really do. And they do a very good job. Like I said like, you know, I was dissatisfied, but in terms of like my experience, like it was like, for what it was so good. Like, you know, working for any one of those companies, like Bain does such an incredible job. Like, company culture is amazing. Like, they do all these things to retain you. Like, they do like fun company, like company-wide events, like global events where you get to meet all the other Bain people from different countries. And like, yeah, they do an amazing job. But yeah, I mean, part of it was itching to build a platform and to be able to speak to the things that I care about. Part of it was seeing my sister's success and being like, wait, that requires risk. Like, if I want to do that, like, I can't just sit here. And then part of it was also just like frustration with the consultant lifestyle, where I was just like, fuck this. Like, I don't want to travel. I mean, I didn't travel that much, but the work-life balance, like, I just felt like I had things to share, like ideas. I had skills that I wanted to put towards the change that I wanted to see in the world. And it was like, it got to a point where I was like stifling, like, I can't do this anymore.
Got it. Well, what are some of those big big missions that you founded some on? Because I know you mentioned before, I believe it, like when you came up with the idea, it's not like you like just went through this process of like, okay, here's like the market need. Here's like the hole that we have to fill with our product. So then how did you come up with this idea?
Yeah. So yeah, it really came from a place of heart. It really came from our own mission. Like that's what Kim and I started with. Like we got together. I remember like we were working like nights and weekends on like starting on some like ideating around it. And the first place we went was like, what are causes that we deeply care about? What are things like changes we would like to see in the world? And we really felt, both of us felt very strongly about educating on the multitudes within Asian culture, because for so long, like Asian America has been seen as this monolith. And there's been like basically very few narratives that have been shared, and they've been largely East Asian as well. And we as Vietnamese Americans were like, there's a lot that we want to educate on here. And like the more we dug into that, like it became very clear to us that like Asian culture was not being represented well, especially in the grocery store. And so we were like, this is like a very clear place for us to like, to make that change. And then as we started to think more and more about what this company could be, the values became like even deeper and deeper. Like part of it was this idea of like, you know, rising tides raise all boats, which is like this idea that BIPOC communities can unlock each other's growth and social mobility and influence in America. And then it became for me more personally, this idea of building like a very heart forward company culture, intentional leadership, things that, you know, in the past year or two, looking at a lot of startup stories, a lot of smaller, high growth companies lack. And so, yeah, there's like so many missions within this one company, but I think at the end of the day, it's really about, educating on Asian America and reclaiming Asian stories and flavors.
Got it. So do you guys, so where do you kind of see like the company expanding towards? Cause right now you guys are in the very early stages. I mean, do you imagine this, kind of scaling to other things as well, or what's the,
yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, what we're trying to build is like the new authority in Asian food CPG. Like we want to be a household name. We want to be in homes across the country. The way that we say it often is like, we want to be sitting in your pantry between your tomato sauce and olive oil, right? Like those are what like people view as staples today. And like, we think Asian products can sit there too. So yeah, I mean, in terms of like where this goes, like there's expansion across categories. So like, you know, we can create different types of products. Like right now we have our starters, which are like kind of like pantry shortcuts, but like, we could do snacks one day, right? We're going into wholesale soon, and we could do that. Like we could expand to there. Like right now, maybe one day we'll be in Whole Foods, but maybe one day we'll be in like Costco, and maybe one day we'll be in Walmart. Like who knows, right? Like I think there's so many ways that we can expand. And so, yeah, we're just getting started.
I want to also ask, you know, just with your own upbringing and your own life experiences, previously you mentioned that you had some like fears and like just like some of your own like personal narratives that you've kind of I guess like placed yourself into that you've had to overcome in order to grow the business or in order to be a great leader. What are some of those things, and where are you now with those things? Like have you overcome them, or what's that journey like?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's been so many. Every phase of my journey has like been defined by like one of these like personal narratives that I've had to break through. Like, I think the very first one was like, basically after I quit Bain, the very first one that I had to break through was this idea that my self-worth is defined by my attachment to reputable names. Like that was a big one, right? Like for most of my life, like that's what I saw it.
Oh, right. Because it's like, I went to Harvard and worked at Bain, like that. Okay.
Yes. And then after I graduated Bain, and like, I was working on a food startup, right? That's all that my whole community, all my friends and family knew. They were like, oh, that's like so cute. Oh, like, is it your mom's recipes? Like, that's so cute. Like it was, people were super condescending about it. And so like, it's so condescending. Like I went from a place where like, you know, it felt like whenever I said where I worked, it was like, okay, like nobody, and people can take me seriously now, which is just so lame in the first place. But like, that's where I was. And then I felt like I was in free fall after that. I felt so much shame. Like I hated going to parties. We were working on it for a year before like anything like really like happened. And then we launched over a year and a half into the journey or so. Like it was basically a year and a half, which is a meaningful amount of time. Like I got that response all the time. So that was the first one of just like, I was like scared. Like my sense of self-worth was just plummeted. And so I had to learn to have my own conviction in myself, mm-hmm. to not let external validation define me. Right. That's like a huge breakthrough, and it's not perfect. Oh, there's still so much work to do there. And every day I try to make strides on it, but it's hard. And especially I think as like an achievement oriented Asian American, like that is the currency a lot of times in Asian America with our parents for sure. Right.
Yeah.
So that was one of the first ones. Another one that came soon after that was money scarcity. Still working with this one now, this like really deep seated, like, fear that like I will not be able to take care of myself, which like stems from my parents being refugees and like coming here with nothing and them telling me stories. Like when I left Bain, Kim and I both like just we only had a couple years in the workforce, so we did not have a lot of money. We don't have generational wealth. We were trying to do like side hustles. Like I was literally like doing resume and like college essay stuff. I was literally sourcing clients through Craigslist. Like that's how I paid my rent for this year and a half. And we made no money and we were like living in New York City. It was so triggering for me. Like I felt again, so much shame. I was like, I'm such a failure. Like my parents escaped Vietnam. They came here to like, you know, they worked so hard to like make money so that they could pay for my like college and shit. And like, mm-hmm. which was a huge privilege. Right. And here I am with like literally no money in my bank. Like it was so triggering. And even today, you know, we're in a place where we have like funding and stuff, but I still feel like I still feel like sometimes I run my business like I'm the Asian immigrant parent that's like saving, like comparing prices of noodle packets across stores to get the best deal, right? Like I feel like sometimes I run my business that way because it's like in my blood, in my psyche. So, which is no way to grow a business, right? You kind of have to like invest to grow.
Yeah, that's fine.
You have to. But you have to do it, like you have to look at measure things from with the measuring stick of ROI as opposed to absolute spend. And like sometimes absolute spend feels so much more seductive to me because of this like upbringing of like what it was like to grow up with parents that were like only buy things when they're on sale, like wait till they're on sale and stockpile on them, right? Like that's the shit that
I had to shift that mentality a lot as well. I mean, that's like a tough one because it's like so much of like your childhood is kind of like imprinted on you. Like I grew up also just like we were on like food stamps, you know, like I was raised by a single mom and it's like everything like you like you know, you're just kind of used to being like cheap because because that's how your mom is, because she had to be like that because she was frugal because we didn't have any money, you know?
Right.
But that's like
right.
No way to do business, you know?
Exactly. And like the thing is like when our parents, like, I don't know if your mom talks like this, but my parents are like, that's how we made it. Because we were like, you know, so diligent about it because we were very scrupulous, blah, blah, blah. And so like in my mind, that is equated to like success, right? Like being super careful, being very, and it's not until like I started working with like certain contractors that are like more senior that they're kind of like, oh, you know, yeah, I can definitely follow up on that expense. But like, that's not something most business owners would like pay attention to. Like if you think about scale, right? Like it would be like small things that I'd be like, look into that. That doesn't make sense. And most other business owners would be like, oh, well, that's relatively small. Like, let's move on from it, whatever. So that's when I started to realize like, oh, do I run my business differently than most other owners? And so it's finding a balance, right? Because sometimes it can serve you, but I think it's just being intentional about when you exercise that kind of muscle.
Yeah, absolutely. I really love what you said about, and I think it's important for any business owner or anyone that's starting a business to know that like it's definitely more about the ROI than the absolute spend, you know, because like if you spend, and I know this because I'm pitching other companies because we help do marketing, and like I know some people are more, it depends on the person I'm talking to, but you kind of like psychoanalyze every person and see like, okay, how receptive are they to spending money. And how do they view it? So it's like a lot of times we have to frame it where it's like, you know, because we charge a lot for a website. It can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And people are like, oh, it's a website. Wow. How do you like charge that much for it? But it's not the absolute amount. It's the ROI. Because if the website is the center of your entire business, and let's say like you generate, I mean, for some of these companies, one sale is like more, is like 100,000, it's a million, you know?
Right.
So I'm like literally build an amazing website. You guys get one good deal, like one sale over the next 3 years. It's going to ROI this thing by multiple times, right? But I know that's a hard thing sometimes to convince people, you know? It's
for
like,
sure, for sure. You
know? But
yeah.
But I know a lot of businesses that they like don't spend money, and they kind of like save their money, and they kind of kick the tire down the road. And like, as a result, the competitors, they, you know, they're investing, they use their money, they spend it, and then other companies fall behind, you know? So.
Yeah, it's hard. It's a dance. Like, you know, then there's the other side, which is like, you know, in the D2C world, there's so many brands that are like, because they have venture backing, they just make it rain all the time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
In a way that's like just not responsible and not effective. So we do this kind of dancing between where we care deeply about operational efficiency early on, but at the same time, we're like prepared to invest to grow. And we invest in experimentation to learn. That's kind of how I like think about it, but it's hard. It's not, we definitely have a strategy and a stance on it, but I wouldn't say it's like, you know, we'll see how it plays out.
All right. I'm trying to check the time. We have a little bit more time. I guess another thing, just being like working in the space as a founder that's Asian American, are there any unique things that whether during fundraising or anything else that you've, you know, encountered that are, you know?
Oh yeah, for sure. I could go on about this, but I'll keep it to a couple of things. I mean, okay. So the first is like, I mean, this is no surprise, but fundraising as a woman, fundraising as a BIPOC person, like things are just like stacked against you. The numbers are freaking crazy when you look at where venture funding goes. And I would say the things that came up most often for me during this process, I would say first, in terms of like market size, like us pitching that we're creating a company that exists first and foremost for Asian Americans. So many VCs right then and there basically were like, oh, that's niche. Like, sorry, that's niche. And we're like, the Asian American wallet is like 1.5 trillion and growing. The Asian American population in the US is the fastest growing population with the fastest growing buying power. Also, Asian cuisine and Asian culture is not just limited towards an Asian American audience, which so many investors did not buy. They were like, oh, well, like, we don't really know if the demand is there. And we're like, do you live in a hole in the ground? Like, Asian Americans are popping, Asian American restaurants are popping up and thriving. David Chang is building his empire. Netflix is making all this original content on like Asian street food. Like, this is a movement. And it's not just on the coastal cities. Like, Asian cuisine is popular around the country. So grocery stores are like obviously way behind, but like restaurants are going to be the first wave, and they're doing all the heavy lifting of educating consumers' palates. And so there were just like lots of investors that were just like, oh, that's niche.
After you said all that stuff, they were just like, they still didn't really buy it or what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They would just be like, yeah, no, like, you know, or like, no, my wife has tried a couple Asian products and she like doesn't like them. So
I mean, that's such
a, you know, like, oh great, that's a great sample size. Like, while I'm talking about demographic shifts, that doesn't, they're like, ah, no, like they would say, literally say things like that, and they'd be like, okay. Or like, we never cook Asian food at home though. That's just something I get for takeout. Like, we don't. And we'd be like, okay, well, maybe there's a reason for that, you know. So definitely a lot of that. And then another thing we would hear often is just this like massive generalization of all Asian brands as if they're just like the same exact brand. So like, for example, when it comes to like granola bar companies, you wouldn't be like, well, you know, RX bar is really, really successful. Or like, let's say, or that's a bad zone because RX bar did well. But like, if a granola bar company failed, you wouldn't necessarily have another granola bar company pitch you and be like, well, look, that one granola bar company failed, so therefore you'll probably fail. But when it comes to Asian brands, they would just group us all together. Even if one was like a snack company and ours is like a starter and sauce company, right? Like, they would just be like, okay, well, that Asian brand failed like 5 years ago. So like, why should we think yours will succeed? And it's like, it's kind of, it's just like this very like frustrating experience of being like, just, they don't like take the stand, the time to understand, like, you have a different strategy, different go-to-market strategy. You have a different brand. You have a different product category.
Yeah, exactly.
And they would just like kind of group you all together, even, even if they were like literally just completely different. So that was really frustrating.
How do you address some of these things? Or maybe once you finally found like the right people to invest, like what did you do differently too? Cause I'm thinking also from the perspective of like any other listener or anyone else, just from like a advice standpoint, like they're going to run into similar issues. Do you have any things that clicked or worked well to get to drive home the points?
Yeah, totally. So the first is just a numbers game of getting to the right people to that see the same future that you see. Like that, that's truly part of it. So you will just have to pitch more people. You will get more no's, you will feel more self-doubt, and you're just going to have to keep plugging on. Like when we raised our pre-seed, like I can't tell you how many days I wanted to give up. My sister has a lot more like internal conviction versus I'm much more like evidence-based. So I would be the one that would have all this doubt, right? And she would be the one to be like, look, like they just don't understand. They don't know. And she would have to coach me, and I would just want to like crumble. Like our pre-seed was so hard. We talked to so many of the wrong people. And it's not until you find like the right, like maybe let's say you talk to 30 people, you finally find one person that gets it. Then that person might introduce you to three of their friends. Two of them don't get it. Maybe one of them gets it. Like that's how you start to meet the right people. So the first thing I would say is just like numbers game, be prepared for the no's, find your crew, like find the people that get it. And then the second thing is like, unfortunately in the like echelon of investors that like write really big checks, for example, there's probably even fewer that get it, right? If you're doing something for a specific audience, specifically a BIPOC audience, you might have more success with like angels, but when you're getting to like the VCs, like that's just like literally such a white male dominated industry. I have been like very honest with people that like I felt like I had to actively do things to try to reclaim power in situations like that. When I first came into fundraising, I was very inexperienced, and I would come in like act like it was like a test, right? Like have all my answers to their questions, like anything they could ask me. I knew the market size. By the time I raised my seed, I totally reframed it, and it became like truly like, how do I make them respect me? How do I make them be inspired by my vision? How do I check their idea that they know everything and put them in their place? Like I did a lot of that. And it was emotionally exhausting. At the end of the day, I felt like a shell of a human, but like I had to do that as a 26-year-old Asian woman to like get them to take me seriously.
Yeah, I can only imagine how difficult that is. I mean, it's like, cause so much of it's not really about like what even like you're saying and stuff like that. A lot of it's like people are just looking at your body language and like, and stuff.
It's how you make them feel. It's how you make them feel. So like, it's truly like a journey. Like what I would do at the beginning was like, make them like me, then, or this sounds so calculated, try to make them like me, then try to make them respect me and like be a little bit contrarian, right? Like push back on them and then make them feel inspired. So it's like a journey, like you and sequence it that way, right? Like, but there has to be basically like, first make them feel like, oh wow, she's like likable and she's like social, whatever. She's friendly. And then it's like, make them like, be like, oh, she might know more than me. And then at the end, build something together. But it has to happen like that.
Yeah, no, Hunter, I agree with that so much. No, it's really how it is. It's like the whole process of sales and pitching and that type of stuff. True. It's like really, it's like building trust. First and foremost, if you don't build trust, nothing else you say is going to matter because there's just me, I don't really believe the person, you know?
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, we always layer on at the end, just like, and the funny thing is like when we've done sales, you know, before it's like, oh, like when we're a small business or we're so like, you know, just not very confident, every deal meant so much to me. It was like, you know, even if it's like a couple of $1,000, I think people could just tell that like it meant a lot, you know? And then that's like a turnoff, you know? And like now it's like when we have a massive deal and like, we're like, yeah, I mean, if you want to work with us, you can work with us. If not, like, whatever, just tell us. You know, and they can tell we don't really need the business, and suddenly the conversion rate is just like through the roof.
No way. No, that's people so interesting.
Yeah,
it's because like, I know that happens for like pitching, but I didn't know that like pitching to investors. I didn't know, because we always talk about like FOMO and trying to create FOMO, but I didn't realize it was similar. Wow.
Oh, for sure. So it's like the second you, and we have clients where like, we don't really want to work with them because they're difficult clients. And we just tell them, we're like, yeah, I don't think we're the right fit. And then instantly, like, they're like, no, like, we're not. It's crazy. And the second you really tell someone you don't want to work with them, literally, they just want to work with you 10 times more. God, it's like, it's, so real. It's absolutely.
It's like playing hard to get.
No, it really is. It's just like in business. Yeah. Do you think you get any privilege being like Asian, being, I don't know if like being an Asian woman, if that's pro or con, but I feel like being Asian is like something, you know, kind of like you probably, I feel like people generally trust Asian people to like be hard workers, you know?
Oh, for sure. I definitely think like, especially if you're looking at what it must be like to be a Black founder, like, oh, but also like,
harder,
yeah.
Way harder, right?
Way harder, I'm sure. I can't even imagine. Way, way harder. So yeah, I think like there's like a whole range, but I feel so much privilege in that way. I think being like a young Asian woman's a little bit difficult because it's, you're kind of look like they, you look younger already. Like they're not necessarily like, oh yeah, like I want to write a big check to this person that looks like they might still be in college. And yeah, I definitely think, but for sure there's, I feel immensely privileged. And I think it's like, I can't imagine what like Black and brown folks feel when they're going into pitches.
Do you feel like, just like being a leader at your company and growing, is there any unique challenges you think just to being like an Asian American founder and a woman too? Like, cause I don't think there's already not that many. Well, no, there's more now. There are like Asian American founders and leaders of companies, but historically, you know, it's like Asian people are kind of like passive or viewed as passive. And I think like people don't fit the criteria of
being a true leader, right? Like that, that ceiling, or they call it the bamboo ceiling, which is kind of a weird phrase, but for sure. I mean, I think like something that is, I'm sure so many Asian folks and Asian women struggle with in any profession is like imposter syndrome, right?
Yeah.
Like all the time. And I'm getting to a place where I have a lot more confidence in myself, but for a long time, it was like tons of imposter syndrome. Like, why am I the one to be doing this? I have no idea what I'm doing. Like, it was real. And basically the solve for me, it's not like fully solved, but I think the mindset shift that really helped me with imposter syndrome is going from a place of like the expectation in the bar being like, I know everything. Like that was what I wanted. I was like, I want to have the answers. I want to know everything, which is literally setting yourself up for failure in any role, but never mind like being a startup founder, because the whole thing is like you're on a vertical learning curve the whole time. Yeah. So now I've shifted it to be like, do I have confidence that I can figure it out? Not do I know everything, but can I figure
that.
It out?
That's really amazing advice. I somehow naturally landed on that same thing a while back, but you articulated it better, I think. It was like in my head.
No, I'm so glad that resonates, because I think that's the difference, right? It's like, you don't have to know everything. And honestly, if your expectation is to have all the answers, you're setting yourself up for an extremely toxic company culture. If that's the expectation, there's no psychological safety in a company that has the expectation that you know everything. Like everybody's going to feel horrible about themselves, and nobody's going to feel comfortable taking risk, being innovative, right? Like if we're actually going to like shift paradigms and change, be the next wave of of companies, we're going to have to allow people to feel safe saying things out on a limb, lobbying something into the conversation that isn't completely well thought out. And I'm saying this out loud from a place of like trying to make myself convince myself too, because like, I have a lot of work to do here, but it's like intellectually, I understand it now. I'm just trying to like internalize it and act on it. But I do believe that that's what I want Omsom to be.
What are some of the top books that you've read recently that you would recommend, or some of them, or just some recent books that you've been reading?
Okay, yeah. Oh, so let's see. First and foremost, everything Brené Brown. She's just so amazing. I'm just obsessed with her. She's one of just like the biggest proponents of like vulnerability, and I just think personally and professionally, like what she has to say is so valuable, is so meaningful, and can make the world a better place. I am right now reading a book called Nonviolent Communication, which I think is very, very important. It's meant to be applicable both professionally and personally as well. So I definitely check that out.
Communication.
Communication. Yeah. And it's about basically how oftentimes we use words to like defend ourselves or to protect our egos and not actually help us achieve what we truly want. And how we can use words to make other people feel at times like unwelcome or unsafe or unheard or unseen. And I have learned that, like, you know, sometimes when I'm scared, I will use words in that way. And so this book has like been really helpful in helping me like unpack that. So I definitely recommend that too.
It's really cool. I'll check it out. It has really great reviews. So
Yeah, it does. It's very good. I'm reading My Year Abroad, which is a new book by Chang Rae Lee. And it's really good. It's fiction, but it's so beautifully written. And it has like a lot of kind of like fun business ideas mm-hmm. in it because of one of the characters named Pong. He has like a lot of like really fun business ideas. One of them is like a Lux hot dog stand that's just like hilarious. But I don't know. I love his prose. It's so beautiful. I would definitely recommend it if you're into fiction.
Do you spend, when you're not working, or like kind of like what do your days look like now? I mean, you guys are still in the early stages. I'm sure there's always like an endless laundry list of work. How do you like kind of like balance that? Do you find time to, you know, disconnect?
Yeah, it's a really important question. So basically, when we launched in May, I had not figured it out yet. And I basically had this expectation that I was like, get through the laundry list every day, which like, if with a lean team at an early stage will literally ruin your life. So May through September, I was trying to do that. It wasn't like I hit this breaking point in September where I felt like a shell of a human. I was like, how could I ever treat myself this way? This is totally not in line with our mission and our values. Like I'm doing this in service of a mission, but I'm not even living that mission internally for myself or for my team. So in September, I had this like kind of like breakthrough that I was like, I need to just draw the line. There's like, I won't cross this line anymore because that's just no way to live. So now
draw a line on like where you stop working, like, or like to separate
how much of it I let absorb my life, basically.
Got it. Okay.
I was like, yeah, I was working till like 11 every day, and I was like working on the weekends at times. It was just like taking over everything, and I didn't think about anything else. Also, it was like during the pandemic and its peak, right? Like back then, like in May, like restaurants, I don't even know if they were open. They weren't. So like, it was so easy to just like let it absorb everything. So starting in September, I was like, okay, like I had a breakthrough that I was like, this is not how it should be. Like, no matter how emotionally connected I am, I need to like draw the line. So yeah, I mean, since then there have been a couple of times where I've been like, whoa, it's getting there again. But now I feel like I have a lot more balance. So yeah, I'm trying to be vigilant about it.
How do you balance it? You just like, do you like turn off your, I feel like I'm like addicted to like Slack and like my email. I just like, I don't even know how to at this point to like draw the line anymore.
It's so hard, especially with like work from home culture. But I think, so for me, it's basically like, as I start approaching dinner, I am trying to be more diligent about looking at like my long ass to-do list and actually being like, what needs to happen tonight? And oftentimes if I do that, like I actually go through that exercise, it's like literally two things that I can get done in like an hour or two or three max. So, and then by that, my goal is basically to like have dinner and try to not work after.
Okay.
And do hobbies. Nice. I have so many hobbies. I love to cook. I love to bake. I love to watercolor. I love reading. I love journaling. Like, I'm very social. I was like, I just need to make time so I can feel like a whole human.
Yeah. So on the weekends, you try not to work too much and try to like do your other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I try to do like max, like a couple of hours if I need to, but in the past couple of months, I actually haven't really been working on weekends, which is good.
It's really good. Yeah. It's really important because then you never kind of have a time to, you know, tune out. So just have a couple of last questions because we're almost out of time. I want to ask, what do you recommend everyone put on their bucket list? Like, do you have something that you've done that has just been like awesome and like that you would really recommend?
Oh, that is
such it can be more than one question. Thing. It can just be.
Yeah. So I don't know if this is like how achievable this is for everybody, but I just, cause it, I got very lucky, I think, but something that has literally like changed my life this past 2 years is that I found a group of Asian women that I feel deeply connected to. And we basically started doing these like bi-weekly meetings where we get together, and I almost like this to be very reductionist, it's almost like some form of like group therapy. Oh, but really sure. It's not like fully that. It's just us coming together, sharing our stories, like kind of going over what we've been working on, like our fears, putting them out in the open, our vulnerabilities, celebrating together, like highlights. And it has been the most just incredibly supportive. It has changed my relationship to myself, honestly, to be able to have a safe space to reflect on my life and my hopes and my dreams and my fears. And now we don't do it every 2 weeks. We did it at the beginning for like a year for every 2 weeks. Now we basically hang out as friends here and there. And then we do now like a quarterly retreat to upstate New York, into the same house. And we get together and it's like a weekend of like journaling and like card games, reflection, like eating, cooking together. But yeah, this is like, I feel like they're like my rock. And if y'all can like find a way to like get a group of people together that you love and create some consistency and create space for that type of sharing.
Is there like a moderator or a leader of that group, or like how did it come to be?
Yeah, so that's initially we actually started by having an intention to do the book The Artist's Way together. Have you heard of the book The Artist's
Way?
Yeah,
I read it. Yeah, the morning journaling, I believe.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So we came together to like just basically every 2 weeks we would go through a chapter, but eventually like halfway through the book, we kind of dropped it. I mean, we still did it on our own time, but the conversations just took on a life of its own. And we like kind of passed around hosting at each other's places, and like that person would like maybe cook a meal or put out.
And everyone's some, like, local, right? Like everyone's local.
Yeah, everybody's That's local. Nice. Yeah. But then during the pandemic, it became on Zoom, which was a little bit harder. Like it definitely got a little bit more tiring, but.
You can't do the side one-on-one conversations too, right? Cause everyone's like.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Or like the follow-up, like, hey, actually this really like, really resonated with me. I'm like, let's talk more. Like we try to do a little bit of that, but yeah, it's still valuable.
Okay. Cool. No, that's a wonderful idea. I wish I had something like that, but sometimes
you can make it.
Yeah, that's why I was asking about a moderator, because I don't know if I would. I could probably make something like that when the time is right. Anything else that any other like bucket list things? Or I mean, that's a great one. I think so many people would benefit from that.
Yeah. Another one is to have a very vulnerable heart to heart with your parents about what it actually is that they want for you. So that one will fuck you up. I think a lot of us as Asian Americans like have these ideas of really what our parents want for us, and maybe they're right, and maybe that's what our parents actually want. But for me, I was like, they want me to be super successful. They want me to have boatloads of money. They want this, they want that. And if I don't have that, I will have failed them. And I remember like that pressure just got to a breaking point, especially like with building this company. And I just like called my dad and I cried to him. I was like, I told him, I was like, I feel so much pressure every day, Dad. Like I want so badly to make you proud. Like I said all these things to him and he gave me this like amazing pep talk. He was like, you are an amazing leader, an amazing person. He was like, you're smart, you're this, you're that. But Vanessa, you have a good heart. You have a good heart. And that is what your mom and me, like, we know you have a good heart. And like the way he said, I literally was like, I was like standing outside one of our chef's restaurants. I was about to go in and do some product development. I was literally on the phone with him, like on like first on in East Village, like I was like crying on the corner because like it was such a beautiful sentiment. Yeah, it was sweet. Freeing to hear. I would say if you feel comfortable, I would say it's really scary to have conversations like that with our parents, but I would say it's really, really important and can be really meaningful.
Yeah. Cool. Last question, just how do people follow you guys? How do they buy your products? How do they learn more? What's the best way?
Yeah. So definitely check us out. Our website is omsom.com. So OMSOM. Our Instagram handle is at omsom. That's really where we put out a ton of our content and our newsletter as well. We have a newsletter called The Shout that my sister puts together every week. That's all about like everything Asian American culture. So definitely check us out on Instagram as well. We have lots of hot takes if you're into that. And then my personal Instagram is at Vanessa T Pham. And yeah, I try to share a little bit about the founder journey and stuff there too.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. I followed your Instagram, your omsoms, and you guys have really beautiful packaging and like everything. It's really well done.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah. We took a lot of risk with it, but I wouldn't change a thing about the way that our branding is, because it's really representative of our ethos.
Yeah. Cool. Any other things you want to add? Otherwise, I think.
This was amazing. This was so much fun. Thank you so much for having me here, Dominic. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks everyone for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Of course, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please feel free to email Dominic at whyyouknowdoctor.com. Until next time.